Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and this evening my guest is Steve Riffman, who is a practicing lawyer and businessman who, from October of 1970 to October of 1971, took a journey that became fictionalized in author F.T. Burke's novel, Wanderer, The Ultimate Hippie Trail Journey. Steve took a journey that crossed many borders and boundaries overseas and was politically and physically challenged, and at times it was quite harrowing. Rockets flying overhead, dangerous car rides, visa challenges, and more. Steve is here today to share his story with us. He was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, and has three children, two grandchildren, and an enduring, love-filled marriage of over 40 years. Steve, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming on and sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Georgiana. It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
Me too, but before we go on your hippie journey, I mean, weren't we all a little bit hippie back in 1970 to 71?
A lot of us were.
I know. But before we do that, I mean, you know, I've got to hear about this enduring love-filled marriage of over 40 years. Tell me about, this is wonderful. Obviously, this marriage happened after your journey, because you were not married when you were there traveling around. So tell us, you've got to give us a little inside scoop. Tell us, because this is a big thing, you know, to have an enduring, love-filled marriage for over 40 years. That's like that's almost as big as your journey.
So it is. It's quite a journey. Well, I'll tell you, it really had a lot to do with my journey, actually, because my lovely wife, Pamela, was a girlhood friend of my sister Deborah. They were 6 grades younger than me, and when I left home, she was only 17, and when I came back, she was almost 18, and it changed everything. But she actually drove with my sister Deborah. They drove me to the airport in Detroit so I could fly for $16 from Detroit to New York on American Airlines on student rates. But she was in the car and drove me there. And then when I came back, my sister Deborah kind of set things up, and I found love at home. I really did, right in my living room.
Oh, wow. So what do you think, you know, I know my listeners and I know what they want to hear. What do you think is the secret to your enduring marriage?
I think it's that my wife puts up with me. She used to say to people, well, I really like Steve, but he's a little wild for me. But I've tamed down, and she tamed me in many ways. But she is a wonderful cook, maybe a chef. She takes care of me. And as I said earlier, she does put up with me because I'm still quite an activist. I think that one of the things that led me to travel was my great love for activity and action. And I am into all kinds of things currently. So I'm politically involved. I'm making a movie. We wrote this book, which we're promoting. And we're doing all kinds of different projects besides running an office with 15 employees and doing mostly motor vehicle accident work for injured victims here in the Detroit, Michigan area. But so I'm a busy guy, but I love this book and I love this story. And the story of my one-year travel is something that's been so enduring. And then eventually what happened, I ran into my friend Fred Burke, and he's the author. He wrote the Bohemian Adventure as well. And he is somebody who helped me to kind of push the project forward to the degree that I was able to take 2 handwritten journals and I converted them into kind of a manuscript, which were basically my journals. But reading the journals and having it be in that kind of fashion, Fred wanted a novel. He had that novelist perspective. He thinks it brings the characters to life more effectively, and I agree with him, and it does that in the book. He uses a technique, which you call present sense impression. So the writing of the book throws you right into the action as if you're actually doing the journey that we did 49 and 50 years ago, as if it were happening to you at the moment as you read it. And I think that's a very exciting perspective because the adventures get very personal when you read it in that sense.
Okay, so
but
you
anyway,
I I can hear the excitement that you have for this book and for the author, you know, who actually, this is your story that was actually fictionalized, correct?
There's a few adventures in there that I wish I would have done, but most of it, way most of it, are things that I actually did. The travel itself is identical in terms of mode and time, and every way that I did it is actually accurate. In fact, that was one of the things that I did. When I read the book, I insisted that it be geographically appropriate and that the journey actually would make sense to somebody who actually had been in those same areas. I remember particularly because at one point in the middle of the journey, I spent about 7 weeks in Israel on a kibbutz, which is a communal farm, and they accept volunteers. And there were volunteers from all over the world at a series of these kibbutzes all over Israel. And then after I was done, though, I wandered around Israel for 3 weeks, and I took one of my friends with me from the kibbutz. And there were some very intricate details in how to travel from a place called Jericho to Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And these places are extremely close. In fact, we were walking between Bethlehem and Jerusalem and sleeping outside on a hill, sliding down a hill in Bethlehem. But the intricacy, and then going from there to the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is an area where you can literally float on your back without doing a thing because the salt density is so high. So we went in there, but the idea I'm getting to is this idea that these distances are not much, but they had to make sense because I was not going to let someone who wrote the book and hadn't done the exact journey screw up, if you will, the details of the journey. So the details of the journey are extremely accurate, which I'm proud of, and we have that on our website, thewandererbook.com, and you can see all the journey that we took on the road in our character Wanderer. Actually called him Woodstock because our journey starts in Woodstock. I literally went to Woodstock, with a 500,000 other people, and that was something that whet my appetite. And one of the themes of our book is that our wanderer character, Woodstock, he meets the Hog Farm Commune, which was a group of hippie people from the West Coast that were helping out at Woodstock. Then Woodstock Wanderer winds up meeting up with a hog farm, and this literally happened to me as well, in Amsterdam a year later. And then I literally wind up meeting the hog farm again after coming back from Kathmandu, Nepal, and being in Benares, India, which is the city, the holy city of India, where the people go down to the Ghats to drink the water and they burn all the bodies. And it's the real central activity of the Hindu religion. And I'm there, and there's the hog farm again. And one of the great things about traveling, and I think we've all experienced this, is the serendipity of running into people over and over again, or seeing somebody, you know, from your high school, in Texas when you're on a trip. But it really happens when you're in a flow of travel. And that's one of the things that I would like to emphasize with our listeners, is that in those days especially, and even today, you know, when you travel, there's certain ways that people travel. And therefore, if you're really traveling distances, you're going to wind up meeting people sometimes repetitively. In fact, when I was on my way back from Kathmandu, Nepal, I go back to Afghanistan. I mean, we really went to some dangerous spots. And Afghanistan at that point was still quite exotic and dangerous, not quite as dangerous as it is today with all the wars and the Taliban, but it was an exceedingly dangerous place in those days. And I was about 11 months on my travel. And I wind up meeting an old friend from my home suburb in Detroit. And there he is. And he comes to me and says, "Hey, Steve." And I was so detached from the travel that I didn't even recognize him. He had to explain who he was to me. I go, "Oh, my God, Larry," you know. And then to top it off, on the way back, I go to Europe and I'm on my way home. I get to Graz, Austria, and I'm eating a Wiener Schnitzel in a bar. And I'm looking up at a television set, which is probably the first time I saw one in 11 and a half months. And there's my friend Larry, who I ran into Afghanistan, who I knew from home. And I said, "Oh, okay. I need to go home, you know?" Too much coincidence here.
Let's do this, because this narrative could be totally wild and all over the place. Let's start at the beginning, okay? At the beginning, okay. Your future wife and her sister basically take you to the airport. What
My sister.
Your sister, okay. And you had gone to Woodstock. So was it Woodstock that set off this desire for you to do something kind of radical, hippie, and free? What set you off on the journey, to travel the way that you did?
Well, I had always been someone who loved history and geography. I read thick books when I was 9 years old that were made for kids, but they were very extensive books. I used to love watching The Jungle Book and things of that sort. Rudyard Kipling and India always fascinated me. And then, of course, we all ran into the great movie, It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh,
Jimmy
of course,
Stewart,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
He always wanted to travel. He never did travel. I said, that's not going to happen to me. I want to go. I'm going to go. So they drove me to the airport, and that was very kind of them. And then I was off on my own. I go to New York. And from that point on, I really did make this travel alone, other than the fact that I wound up meeting people and spending extensive time with them. But back to the question, what was it burned me to do this? Yeah, the hippie thing and the Beatles and the talks about the great musicians of India. And you had Ravi Shankar. He was at the great what was his instrument again? He played at Woodstock, and Woodstock had an Indian, the great Swami Satchitananda, began Woodstock with a prayer. So he had all this kind of Eastern influence. But then, and he also had, like, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young played at Woodstock. They were one of the great features. And they had a famous song about the Marrakesh Express, and that was the train from Casablanca to Marrakesh, which I actually wind up taking. I was on third class. It really wasn't pretty, but it did get me between those two cities. But there was a real fever in the air about this kind of travel. And when you got to Amsterdam, from New York, I wind up going to Luxembourg, and I meander into Amsterdam. And when you hit Amsterdam, it was like being in the cantina scene from Star Wars. Everybody was coming and going from outer space back again. And outer space was, wow, they were coming in from India, dripping with beads and chillums, pipes they used, and all kinds of specialized items of India. And there I was, this kid, coming overseas, had a little bit of flavor, but you see the veterans off the road, and you feel like a punk, because you really are. You know from nothing. And then after you travel a month, 2 months, 3 months, you become kind of a hardened veteran, so you can handle keeping up with this flow. But there was a traffic that was going on at that time that was exceeding. And it was definitely part of the hippie model. We found hippies, and that was interesting, from all the countries of Europe, really. And that was something, until you went overseas, you had no idea. But it meant Spanish hippies, Austrian hippies, and German hippies, and French hippies. And they were all part of this international scene that was moving around. Because once you got overseas, being an American was powerful, because we hippies were like, of America, we were like the bosses of hippieism. They saw you wearing Levi's, they would have paid $200 for a pair of Levi's, even in
those
days.
You're kidding. Really? Really?
Oh, yeah. They wanted American culture. And the kids of Europe who were mimicking and reflecting off it, even though I think we took a lot from the British and the Beatles and all that, but the American scene and the anti-war scene was whipping all this up. And all these other foreign nationals, Swedish people, it was basically Europeans. They really got into it. But then when you got into these places like Morocco, you would see that the Moroccan people, certain of them, would tune into it. And all over Morocco, I'd be walking around with my long, curly hair, and they'd be going, hippie, 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 just shouting out hippie.
Really?
And then people would say to you, why hippie? What's this hippie? Cause some people didn't get it at all, and you really had a hard time explaining it, especially in some bastard French that I was speaking from high school, because they were really, Arabic speaking, and it was the language thing was very challenging. You had to smile a lot. You had to bow. You had to learn how to count to 10. Yes, no, thank you. You're welcome. And basically speaking, you were on your own in most of these countries. Although English is and was, I believe, the language of the world, it's still not something that people in India speak very well. They speak Indian English. And those folks, even though English is the language of the country, they speak 100 different major languages in India. And when I say major language, that's the language the folks of India speak. They use English because the English came and controlled the place and left it with their language and their railroads. And that what brings me to railroads. I mean, railroads are an amazing part of the traveler, especially Europe. Indian railroad system, which was built by the English, is absolutely an amazing phenomenon. Because you've got, I think, four classes of travel. When you get into third and fourth class, you cannot believe the whole India is on the train. I mean, people are bringing families with, you know, I think they get a goat on, they would. You know, it's like you walk in to the train station, people are living in the train station. You know, it's like a whole family's going, women are going to the bathroom over in the corner because they're living there waiting for 3 days for the next train. And
wow.
It gets, when you finally get to India, the intensity of humankind is almost overbearing to the degree where, you know, you could be in Europe, you could sleep out, this and that. You wouldn't really want to do that in India because the people that are sleeping out, and there's many of them, are itinerant or they're these sadhu people. There are millions of people that we might call bums here in America or homeless people. They call them holy people in India. So when you finally get to India, the whole world shifts into a kind of intensity that is, I think, unimaginable. There's a few good movies that give you a hint, but there's nothing like actually getting there.
Wow. So we're going to get back to that some more. But when you and I talked in the pre-interview, we talked about how did you manage to afford to do this? And I know you shared some things with me. I mean, it's hard to believe. We're going back pretty far. But you actually could pull this off. What was the sum total of all the money that you had for a year on your trip? It was, like, ridiculous. How low was the amount of money that you had actually used or accumulated for that trip?
Okay, so I was house painting in college. And I had about $800 stowed away. And I put $500 in my pocket, gave $300 to my older brother to hold for me. And I said, you can send it to me when I need it. And I wound up borrowing another $500 from him. So I think the total sum is $1,300. It includes air flights. It includes boat trips. But I did make 28 cents a day when I was on that kibbutz communal farm in Israel. And they kept me up, they fed me, and they gave me clothes, and for a grand total of 28 cents a day. Other than that, I worked one day in the south of Israel. I made $5, and I said, this is not for me. Somehow or another, I'm going to get back to America where I can do something and I can make some money like Americans make. But I got to a certain point. I was in India, and people would send me money. I'd say, okay, you can travel further. Steve will send you a couple $100. I say, okay, and I get to India. I'm actually down to zero. I'm borrowing. I met two English fellows going into Afghanistan. We spent about a month or two together, and that was a lot of fun. They were great guys. They were loaning me money. And if those guys would have disappeared, I don't know what I would have done.
I'd make
my way somehow to the U.S. Embassy and hope and pray. But basically speaking, I was below zero at that point. So it was a challenge. And, of course, getting money was a challenge. You had to go to an American Express office. We had things called traveler's checks. We did not have credit cards. There was basically no technology. And that made things very challenging. I think I had two phone calls in a year with my family at home. And they were always like at 6 o'clock in the morning at a Fez, Morocco post office because you couldn't even find a phone that would let you call home. And you had to find them at some hour when they might be home because it wasn't like you could call your brother's cell phone. Those long did not exist.
Wow. Well, it was certainly a different world. And we're going to take a very short break, a little commercial break here. And when we come back, let's talk about life in the 70s as compared to today. And let's look at your journey, because if we look at your journey and some of the things that you went through, it could never be done today. 50 years later, you could never pull it off. Okay. So After the break, we're going to come back, and I hope you'll share with us. There were some, you know, remarkable things like you're talking about, the phones and everything else that went on back then. And it was a very different experience, a very different world, and we want to hear more about your journey. So, listeners, don't go away. We will be right back with Stephen Rifkin.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful peer presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
And we're back with attorney Stephen Rifkin, who took a journey from October of 1970 to October of 1971, kind of around the world, in my opinion. And that journey actually became written up or fictionalized in a book called Wanderer, The Ultimate Hippie Trail Journey. Steve, before the break, we were talking about the world as it was in 1970, 1971. Very different place, very different experience. What were some of the things that really allowed you to get away with this? Because look, if somebody were to travel today, just the security at the airports, the cost of things, the restrictions on Americans or the restrictions on, you know, visas and things like that. What was the climate like back then that really allowed you to do this journey and to do it with the freedom that you were able to do it with?
I think it still was a great struggle. It was never easy. Today, it may be impossible. In fact, somebody wrote a book recently called Recreating the Hippie Trail. They tried to go from Istanbul to Kathmandu, Nepal. And he got caught. He couldn't go through Iran, really, which I went back and forth through. He couldn't go through Afghanistan. So those are two gigantic countries. So getting there overland for $27. That was the whole idea. There was this amazingly cheap way to get from Istanbul to Kathmandu, Nepal for $27. Now, it took stopping and getting a visa. That kind of thing still was difficult way back when. Like I had one incident. I'm going through Iran, and Iran is one big country. This is pre-Islamic revolution. There was the Shah was the head of Iran, and there was a lot of begrudging attitudes against Americans because they blamed us for putting the Shah in, and they wanted him out. The people even then wanted him out. It wasn't until 7-8 years later. But I wound up going to a city called Mashhad in eastern Iran, the last major city on the way to Afghanistan to get my visa. As I'm going in, I find out from a couple of Pakistani fellows I was meeting in my flow of travel, and they go, "Oh, it's a holy day. You can't get a visa today because everything is shut down." Well, meanwhile, thousands and thousands of pilgrims are coming to this tomb, and there's this wonderful mosque, and I get all swept up in this event. They're cutting the heads off of sheep, and parades of men in silk uniforms flogging themselves with chains are marching
out
of the blood. I mean, I went into the courtyard, and there were literally thousands of people. Now, these are Shia Muslim, and they are very intense, and it was a very intense circumstance. Now, my Pakistani buddies told me, "Steve, put your Arabic kafaya on, that's a headdress, put your jalaba on I had from Morocco," because they knew I had this stuff, and they won't know who you were. We'll tell them you're from Morocco, because if they know you're a heathen, they might kill you. So, okay, I go into the courtyard, into the mosque, wearing all this getup, and I'm going, "Ma'asalam alaikum," and giving my 25 words of Arabic that I know. But it's an extremely dangerous circumstance. In fact, I went back the next day because I had to get the visa. And 24 hours later and more, these guys were still whooping them up, and they were whipping themselves, and they were whooping and doing prayer chants and everything. And it was such that I could not go on one side of the street in the main part of town. You stay over there, you're all right over there, but don't go on that side because you're going to be in big trouble. So that was a very exciting part of getting into Afghanistan. But then you get into Afghanistan, and again, it's one of these things like Morocco where the world just goes medieval, and everybody's walking around in turbans and long flowing gowns, and you got people coming from all different areas because you're in Central Asia. There's Mongol-looking people. There's Indian-looking people. There's Euro-looking people, Arabic-looking people, this great amalgam of humanity. And they're only men, of course, on the street, except if you see a woman, she's wearing, you know, the covers with actually a screen on their face. You cannot even see the eyes of the women when they do walk down the street. These are the, I'm struggling for the name, Bukhara, I think. And you have such an amazing curtain between Afghanistan and Iran. And it's so intense. Of course, that becomes this hotbed of struggle. When I was there, the Afghanis themselves were technologically so backward, they couldn't even build a major highway. So the Russians built the road from one city to the other city. The Americans built another one. The Russians built a big tunnel through the mountains. So they were getting all kinds of aid, and there was this this prelude to the civil wars of Afghanistan. With you'd see it this way. If an Afghani had Russian cigarettes, you knew his loyalties were to them. If he had U.S. cigarettes, you knew he was an American sympathizer. And it was very strange and exotic, and there were things going on that, for me as just a young kid walking around, I couldn't figure it out, but I knew something was going on. You had people wearing trench coats and black shiny shoes, and you knew they were working for somebody, but you weren't sure who.
So would you say that that time and that place was it intrigue? Was it romantic? Was it frightening? What was the, I mean, it's such a different time now, such a different time and place. What would you describe the culture, the environment? What was it like back then as opposed to now? And, you know, we had talked about some of the things that you could not pull off. You just simply couldn't pull them off today. What do you think would be the biggest challenge for people to try to have a journey of that type today?
I think it would be Afghanistan and Iran and Syria. I was in Syria, okay? I mean, the city of Aleppo, which is a great treasure of culture, has been destroyed. You know, so there's, and you had we had people went out into Palmyra in Syria where the Roman ruins were. Those have been destroyed. In Afghanistan, the Taliban went and they had these Bamiyan. I didn't go there, but I thought about going. It was part of the culture. They had these huge Buddhas carved out of the mountain, and they actually bombed those. So you've seen destruction of cultural icons by fanatics, really. And that, I think, is the main change. I remember thinking in the late 80s when the USSR seemed to evaporate miraculously before our eyes, and I thought, wow, we don't have any enemies. Little did I know that all of a sudden you'd get what I like to sometimes refer to as the crazies, excuse me, but you know, you got people that are just absolutely zealots and lunatics, and they don't even stand up for any particular country. So we never saw that coming. So I think that whole thing, I mean, that fills the Middle East now. And even what's going on in Iran. I mean,
so do you think the world is a safer place? I mean, what was a safer place? You know, it was a safer time, easier time. Were you scared? You know, were you ever frightened? I know people traveling today, some people will not travel because, you know, what's going on in the world is really intimidating. It's a little on the crazy side. So how would you, you know, describe what it felt like then? Was it less frightening? Did you have, you know, airport security that was going on and, you know, all of that type of thing? What was your sense? Was it kind of Woodstocky, or was it more like, a police state traveling around?
I'd say it was more police state, frankly. I mean, in Spain, Generalissimo Franco, who was a fascist from before World War II, still controlled Spain. I had altercations with the National Spanish Police called the Guardia Civil. They arrested me and four other fellas on a small island out in the Mediterranean Sea and made us walk around chasing our passports around. We were lucky they didn't keep us. They made us get on a boat, go from one island to another island. And then I had situations when I was in Cyprus. The Turkish police arrested us there.
So why were they arresting you, Steve? Yeah, but what were you guys doing?
Well, let's see. The first time I mentioned, we were swimming naked. They didn't like that.
Okay.
I was arrested in England by the Bobbies, and that was because I was with a group of folks who were smoking some hashish in a little graveyard, and they caught us and hauled us in, but they let us go. And the time in Cyprus, I don't know. I think these people were just suspicious. They thought maybe we were involved with the Greeks. The island of Cyprus, and it still has this in it, is 80% Turkish and 20% Greek. And the Greeks and the Turks, in case you don't know it, don't get along. In fact, eventually, I traveled between Turkey and Greece. And there were soldiers on each side of that border. There was a bridge over the river. In fact, we have a picture of that bridge on our website, wandererbook.com, which is a lot of fun to look at. And if you look at it, you can see that picture of this bridge where I walked across and I thought, why are there soldiers on each side of it? Why is there such problems with going from one country to another? I am an internationalist. I believe in it. And I don't believe in borders. And I think the more we try to clamp down, the more problems we're going to have. It's not that different than the drug problems. You know, it's like the war on drugs. Well, that doesn't work. And neither do international borders, in my opinion. But these borders presented huge problems. I think I mentioned to you yesterday, at one point, I was going from Syria to Turkey. Well, if the guy doesn't want to let you in the country, you're not getting in unless you want to be sneaking around and, you know, risking your life. And so they said to me, well, you guys haven't had your cholera shots. And I was with a fellow I met in Syria who was an American guy.
I just have to alert the listeners. This is a great story because it's so, like, contrary to what would happen today. And it's so contrary to hygiene.
Well, we hope it's contrary. Okay, so I'm like at the end of the earth. I'm going from Syria to Turkey, basically alone. I'm traveling with a guy I met a couple of days before that. And here we are entering in Turkey. And there's the guard. He says, you guys haven't had your cholera shots. So he goes to Lad, my friend. He says, puts the shot. He gives him the shot, takes the needle out, and gives me a shot. Didn't even put alcohol on anything. I said, I wasn't in any position to say no, really. And as a dumb kid, I just took it. So that was kind of scary, and I didn't die.
And you didn't die, which is pretty amazing. So what do you feel was your takeaway from this adventure that you had? What do you feel that the reader takes away from your experience and, you know, can understand the world a little better?
I think there is underlying all these crazy adventures, and there's drugs, and there's some sex, and there's a lot of other things. There's a religious and spiritual underpinning to our story. I saw the Pope. I saw the Dalai Lama, both in person, at public audiences. I was in mosques, and I saw God everywhere I went. Literally, okay? You can't go anywhere where they don't have God. And I, as a young man, was wanting to know the answer to that. Is there a God? And I came to my senses and said, well, Steve, if there's God everywhere, who are you to say no? So one of my things is I believe there's a God. And I believe it from traveling around and seeing God everywhere. And I believe that basically the nature of humankind is good. We've got people out there who make trouble and get angry and all that kind of stuff. And I had instances that were quite scary. 100 kids throwing stones at me in a schoolyard in Fez, Morocco. I had in Beirut, Lebanon, I had an angry crowd pushing at me and this and that. But I still feel that, basically speaking, humankind is very kind. And they put me up a lot of times. And I was looking pretty ratty, by the way. You know, so I was not like a normal human being from the United States. And I ran into quote-unquote tourists. We didn't fashion ourselves as tourists, by the way. There was a big difference. We were travelers. We were journeyers. And we did not think we were tourists until we got to India. And when you get to India, buddy, you're a tourist because you are not living in their economy and everybody knows it. And that's what things really changed.
So what do you think about the difference between Americans? I mean, you know, Americans take a lot of heat. You know that. We take a lot of heat. What do you think about the difference in how Americans behave themselves and, people around the world perceive us in terms of, you know, how we conduct ourselves in the world?
That's a great question. I just finished reading a book called Culture Code. And it dealt with how different societies think of things and have their own mores. The reality is that we are an adolescent society culturally. We're still growing up. Compare us to an age-old society like the French, where they have, you know, historic, and they've been worn down, so they're not so brash. We're brash. And we take that ad, listen, we want things now. And I believe that the world loves and hates that at the same time. You know, I had people, I had a doctor in Iran, and he spends an hour telling me how bad Americans are and how we shouldn't support the Shah and all that stuff. And by the time we were through talking, he said, hey, by the way, I'm going to meet you in Chicago. We'll have some vodka. We'll get some women, and we'll have a great time, you know. And this is the guy who was so all holy about what was wrong with America. They want this, too. We have something fantastic here. We have all the people of all the world are here, and we have such great plenty, such an incredible society with so much technology and culture, that we're the leaders. And I believe that we need to be the leaders of the world because of the fact that all the world is here and is, in a sense, our burden. So I love that challenge for us as Americans. But I believe that we have to be leaders. We are leaders. We have to accept the culture. And I like to say this. I like to say, God bless America and the world. Because if you don't include the rest of the world, America isn't getting that far. So we have to be both the bold leaders changing things, but we also have to be working with everyone else. And I think the world loves us, but they do hate us. They hate us because of the fact that we're powerful. We flex our muscles. We've created situations all over the world, like in Iran with the Shah. And today we're still out there. And I'm not saying that's wrong, by the way. I don't want you to get me wrong. I'm saying that that's the price of what we are. You know, we're the power of the world. I liken what we are, in a sense, unfortunately, in many ways, to Rome. You know, Greece is to Rome as Britain is to the United States. We speak their language. We have their law. We take their culture. And when I traveled, by the way, I wound up meeting so many great English travelers. They have a culture for that that wasn't waiting for hippies. Those kids over there, and I met one of them in northern Afghanistan, and he was a guy from Cambridge University who was studying history, and he wanted to see the Khyber Pass because it was a part of history. So he was there not as a hippie, but he was a nice guy, and he walked around with me, and I enjoyed him, but he was a quote-unquote straight. So you get out into the real world, and those delineations between straight and non-straight and hippie and regular folks, those kind of disappear because when you're in Afghanistan, I can relate a lot better to a quote-unquote straight American than I can to an Afghani who I don't even know their language. In fact, I don't even know what language they speak because in Afghanistan, they have languages and tribes. You're dealing with such complicated cultural situations all over the world, but it's different. You know, we here are more mixed. They're veins of culture. You've got tribes, you've got languages. It becomes so complicated. And we think from here, oh, India. You know, India is so many different things, you can't even count them. No one can count them. Their language, their dialects are thousands, literally, you know. So you go from one town to the next, you don't know what language they speak, far less than even read it.
Let me ask you this question. Have you been traveling in the last 20 years to any of the parts of the world that you were in, you know, during your journey?
That's a great question. I don't travel that much. I've got a family. When I go away, I got to go down to Arizona to see my son. I would like to take more time. My wife does not want to travel like that. Although we, in recreating this journey, have fashioned doing a movie, doing all kinds of things, and I would love to go back to Morocco. I can't get my wife to go to England. So, you know, it's definitely a challenge. I would like to do it, but I must say, though, I've learned that traveling is very rigorous. It's much easier for a younger person. I went on a plane 2 weeks ago to New York City, and getting on a plane is such a pain in the butt. And the whole rigors of the TSA and all this stuff, and I do travel intermittently. I'm not saying I don't travel at all, but basically speaking, it is way worse. I mean, I had one incident when I went from Rome, Italy, to Israel. I flew on LL, the Israeli Airlines. Now, they always had the hyper security because they've had those issues as long as the state of Israel has been in existence. So they took my knife from me as I was entering the plane. And of course, I forget to get it back when I'm leaving the plane. So now I'm without a knife. That's one of the things on my journey. I always had to have a knife. You know, you'd have some kind of tool, open a can of beans or whatever you had to do with it, you know.
Yeah, there's a universal tool.
That kind of security.
Isn't there some kind of universal tool? It's like a Boy Scout thing that you can use, you know, on the various, you know, journeys of various things that you need to take care of. I guess that's what you had with you, something like that.
Well, I actually had some kind of just, it was more like a pocket knife, but then I actually had five knives in a year. I would lose it. They would take it from me. And then I would have to, when you're in Afghanistan, you buy the knife they've got. You don't have much choices. They don't have Kmart's or Walmart's in Afghanistan. They still don't. And so those kinds of things, you wind up getting picking up items because what's available, you know, not what you'd like to have. To the degree, when I was coming back to Afghanistan from Kathmandu to Nepal, and this is explicated in the story as well, and by the way, you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It is available. We're working on doing an audio version of it, but so you look up our book, it is available to you folks. And that is, though, I'm coming back to Afghanistan, and I'm wearing a pair of rubber sandals, and the rubber sandals break. I don't have any other shoes. I'm in Kabul, Afghanistan, which is the capital of Afghanistan, and I walked around for 4 or 5 days before I could find a pair of shoes I could wear, because the people in those days were wearing curly-toed shoes with hobbles on the bottom of it. I couldn't wear that stuff. You had to be wearing that your whole life. So I find myself in a predicament where I can't even find a pair of shoes that I'm able to wear on my feet comfortably, and it literally took 5 days to come up with them. And yet, in my journals, which I have in my presence right now, I didn't even mention the fact that I was shoeless. You know, so go figure. But I think the state of mind you get into in travel is such a different thing, especially as a kid. I really learned a lot, so much that when I finally figured out how much I learned, I became inspired to become a lawyer.
Is that what did it for you, you know, traveling around and, you know, experiencing everything? What was it about that travel? What was it about that experience that made you look at the law? That's a question I'm going to leave floating in the air. We're going to take our last break. When we come back, we'll have about 8 minutes or so left to talk about what this journey has given to your life, as an adult, as a father, as a husband, as a lawyer. But in the meantime, listeners, don't go away. We will be back with Steve very shortly. But do consider that question, because when we come back from break, we're going to talk about it. Don't go.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior.
Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
And we are back with attorney, I'm so sorry, I'm trying to clear my throat, with attorney Steve Riffman, who has been telling us a fabulous, sharing with us a fabulous story, his tale of the hippie journey that he took back in 1970, 1971. And before the break, Steve, I asked you some questions. So if you could you address, these curiosities about, what this experience has brought to you? What was it about the experience that you decided to become an attorney? And what has all of this, how has all of this kind of rolled in and manifested itself now for you as a human being along your adult life as a father, a husband, and as a professional?
I consider myself to be inspired. And I was inspired as a result of kind of my own spiritual evolution on this travel, from being, excuse the expression, kind of a punk kid to getting to the point where you get your sea legs, where you finally get comfortable. And then in some ways, I feel that God spoke to me to said, Steve, go to law school. In fact, it happened on my first night in Afghanistan when I was shoeless. And I had a little kind of iconic revolutionary realization time. And I felt like I could carry that through. But I think the real answer about the law is that it's something that I was interested in before. In fact, I had actually applied to one law school, University of California at Berkeley. I thought, well, that was Berkeley. It was a hotbed of hippiedom and all that stuff. If I could get in there, I would go there. So I did have some idea of going to law school. When I didn't get into Berkeley's law school, that set me free to go on my journey. Because if I would have gotten in there, who knows, I might have gotten locked in. So I wind up going after 2 years off from undergraduate school. The other thing you should understand is there's an underpinning of the commitment to military service at that time, because we had a draft, and the draft was a big deal. When I, quote-unquote, beat the draft, I actually had a physical deferment that was legitimate. But that set me free to travel after 4 years of deferment on a special student allocation for the draft. But I love the law, actually. I have to say that. And it's something that I see as universal principles. I think there are legal principles in spiritual law that are at one. They kind of unify in some sense. So I look at myself as a universal character. My life is filled with the stories of that 1 year. It seems crazy because I've done so many other things since coming back. I've led a Main Street movement here in Detroit, Michigan, which I like to feel had a lot to do with turning the city around. We're making a movie about that. I do all kinds of projects and things. But underneath it all, this experience of setting myself free by being alone, by learning about myself, by learning about the world, it really is the rudder of my life. And it's something I love to share with people because I don't see where everybody gets this opportunity. I had to fight to get it, really. You know, just like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. Well, he lost his fight. I felt I won mine. And my life is a wonderful life. And it's filled with the law. I love the idea that we in this country have law above everything, that we can take our grievances in front of a neutral magistrate, that we can have things decided, that they can be determined without having to have an argument or a duel, like Hamilton dying from a duel, which is insanity. But we've reached the point where in this country, we are a nation of laws, and that inspires me as a lawyer. And I think in some ways, it's higher even than religious law, that we are able to civilly interact with each other and can air our grievances and have them determined. And I love being a part of that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very thorough answer. Now, to conclude this discussion, tell us what this journey has meant for you, your family, your wife, your children. What have you been able to bring to the table, to your life, to your family, to your work, from this journey in particular that has made a difference for you?
I think it's the love of humanity. It's the fight that we have to, you know, get along, as I was saying earlier, and to make sure we get along in a way that's positive. And I think that, unfortunately for my family, they've heard these stories, some of them too many times. But it amazes me how there are certain tales and things that happen to me that I haven't told yet, or that they're not in the book. And I love that aspect of it because of the fact that I have that rich experience of my own that I do love sharing with people. And I do find that people usually enjoy hearing the tales.
Right. And do you feel that there was some emotional or spiritual experience that you had that really has colored your life or given an underpinning to your life that was very specific to that journey in that time in that place?
Yes, I do. As I said before, it's the idea of being inspired and not to take things as being ordinary in any sense. I think the world is magical and wonderful, and we keep having to bang away at that magic. And sometimes it's a matter of what you tune into. You know, you can look at things differently. I heard something recently. Someone said, I have to make a phone call. And then someone else said, no, you get to make one. So I think that we get to be here. It's a great experience to be human being. I know we've got our rigors, but I know that we can and are doing better as a human race. And I think that there's an evolutionary circle going on here. We're going up a level. And when you think about what goes on here today, 100 years ago, a woman could not vote either in England or this country. Think about that. And so
We
are making real progress. Thank God.
Wonderful. Well, I can see why. I can now understand more why you've had over 40 years of a love-filled marriage. You're very positive. You're very enthusiastic. It's very clear that you're excited. You're excited about things, and you're excited about life, and you're excited about the work that you do. I think it's fantastic. Steve, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your story. And
thank you. And I hope our book catches that excitement, by the way. I know it does.
Well,
it's a really fun read. So please take a look at it.
Wonderful. Thank you again so much. And listeners, don't forget to join me again next week for another interesting, inspiring, and uplifting story on living above the drama.